Only two more lectures left.
Today I will talk mostly about extra-dimensional things and some things that are related to extra-dimensional things, but indirectly. And then tomorrow I will talk about supersymmetry, which is the closest thing to religion in our field, so I thought it would be good to do that on Good Friday. So we'll do that. We'll do a lot about supersymmetry, and I'll do my particular viewpoints of supersymmetry on Friday, and hope to brainwash you on that a bit. Okay, so extra dimensions is an idea that has a long history. Its history is at least as far back as Kaluza and Klein. And as we all know, Einstein was very much enamored by extra-dimensional theories. And I want to first tell you some of the developments over the last 12 years or so, starting with this large extra-dimensional scenario of ADD. I'm just going to go through the basics of that, because if you don't know the basics of it, you should. And then I will even more briefly go through the basics of Randall-Sundrum idea. And then tell you what I think this has to do with Higgs boson physics in a lecture week. What kind of signatures come out? All right, so first, the large extra dimension scenario. It is the idea that we live in a higher dimensional space. The gravity propagates in some capital D dimensional space, which is our 3 plus 1 dimensions plus delta. So delta is our extra dimension degrees of freedom. And we can just assume for our field theory purposes that it's in some factorizable space, R4 cross M. And the gravitational action is given by this fundamental scale, MD, the fundamental scale being approximately a TeV. That's what we will settle upon, is approximately a TeV in the neighborhood of the weak scale. And there are steps involved, of course, in this arrow, this fat arrow. But if we assume that we have some compact extra-dimensional volume, which, let's say, is compactified on some torus, so the volume is 2 pi r to the extra-dimensional power, and we place that in to our theory, we integrate over the extra-dimensional coordinate, and we get out a gravitational Einstein-Hilbert action, which is the normal form that you are used to, plus multiply by this coefficient. And this coefficient needs to be m Planck squared in order to recover Newton's law. And this m Planck squared is this 10 to the reduced m Planck is 10 to the 18th GeV. And we said that we want the fundamental scale of nature to be of order TeV. I recall from last time that the reason why we want to do that is that we don't want any quadratic divergences in the Higgs sector that get out of control. And this will provide that by having a cutoff of a TeV. Well, that means that the radius of this compactification has to be extraordinarily large. So it's a huge radius multiplied by sort of weak scale, TeV scale, has to give you the Planck scale. So this isn't really, as it stands, a solution to the hierarchy problem, but a recasting of the hierarchy problem. And perhaps that recasting of the hierarchy problem where you ultimately stabilize these extra dimensions will be beneficial. Now, the size of this extra dimension needed in order to recover Newton's law is for two extra dimensions, R inverse in the 10 to the minus 4 eV region, which is in the millimeter region, R is in the millimeter region. So there's some direct detection probes of this two extra dimensional scenario that go down quite low and more or less rule out the possibility of two extra dimensions. Just sort of the simple standard two extra dimensions. If you go to four extra dimensions, The R inverse is 20 kiloelectron volts, and for 6, it's 7 MeV. And that's not really ruled out by anything. These are still extraordinarily large radius, but it's not ruled out. And this sets the size, this R inverse, sets the size of the Klutze-Klein excitations of these gravitons in the extra-dimensional space. So you can do a decomposition of some field that depends on the coordinates, normal coordinates plus the extra-dimensional coordinates y. That decomposition in this very simple geometry is regular field, Klutze-Klein reduction in these regular fields indexed by this vector n of integers and times this exponential factor in the extra-dimensional space. And so the Klutze-Klein modes are mass squared equal the n squared, so take this vector of integer entries, squared over r squared. And so in this lattice of integers of the extra-dimensional space, there are distances from the origin, and you multiply that by r inverse squared to get the mass of each of these Klutze-Klein states in the extra-dimensional space. Now, if there happens to be a zero-mode mass, you add that to it. In the case of the graviton, that's not expected to have that mass. Okay, so...
Modifications
of Newton's law, so fit for step experiments. Yeah.
Well, since you've been stuck on that point, the statement that it's ruled out is a sensitive function to what m was, right? If you took 10 TeV, then you would have a factor of 100 in your radius, and then you're...
That's right. Okay. So let me be careful how I phrase that. It's ruled out from the original motivations of having a TeV. So I was stating the term TeV as the scale of MD. You'd have to go up to tens of TeV in order to have the two extra dimensions survive. There's actually another way to have them survive, which maybe I'll make a comment on since we're talking about it. I get derailed easily, as you know, so be careful about your question. This is a very simple topology, and the Klutze-Klein modes that are involved in this topology sort of continually fill this lattice from zero up to infinity in quotes. But if you have a more complicated topology, then you could banish the low-energy modes. And those low-energy modes are really what are causing problems for the low-energy constraints, like fifth force experiments, like supernovae spitting out very light graviton, Klutze-Klein excitations, which decay into protons. EGRIT has data which constrains that very well. But you can get rid of those by having this extra topology, which some authors have some more complicated topology, which some authors have pursued in the past. So I won't really go that direction here to talk about that too much.
Can you say precisely how you get rid of it? Because the space is compact, don't you still have the zero mode? So.
You still have the zero mode, that's right. So what you do is you make some topology which is particularly complicated with handles and so on, such that the first Klutze-Klein mode, for example, first KK mode, cannot sort of fit in that space.
Yeah.
And so only the very high energy, small distance ones fit.
So you have a big gap to go first.
That's right. So you have a gap. So in this, if I jump ahead to, yes, please.
Sorry, just delta is always integer, right?
That's right, yeah.
How can rational number?
No, it's always considered an integer here. Okay. Now, I won't say with total proof that there's no way you could think intelligently about it, about the non-integer delta, but... So here, the interactions with matter are the Klutze-Klein excitations of the graviton multiplied by the energy momentum tensor divided by the coupling constant is 1 over n Planck. If you want to think about a generic prediction for a cross-section that radiates a graviton, a Klutze-Klein, a graviton in extra dimensions, or a collection of Klutze-Klein excitations in gravitons, then this kind of cross-section calculation is what you should have in mind. There's a coupling, which is 1 over n Planck squared. That sets the cross-section. Cross-section's units are 1 over mass squared. But then there's a multiplicity of gravitons. So there's not just one graviton that's made, but this would be the gravitational cross-section of needing one graviton at LEB or LHC if there were just one graviton. But if you have the Kaluza-Klein excitations on top of that, you have a multiplicity. But the multiplicity available to you in the production cross-section is limited by what energy you are scattering at. And the computation is the energy times the radius to the delta power. This is the multiplicity of gravitons that are being created in some energy E characteristic scattering process. Now, if I put that in to this equation, and I then write out what R needs to be, R is given by that lower left expression in terms of the fundamental scale, of sort of TED scale in Planck. So I substitute that into here. I have E delta this. The M Planck's cancel out, and I get E delta to the D 2 plus delta. So this scattering process is being controlled by the low energy scale. And this is what you would get if you did your computation in the extra dimensional space. And you get this out without having to go through the Kaluza-Klein excitation intermediate stages. So you get this value. This is a very high power energy dependence in the numerator. This is a very odd thing from the standpoint of particle physics to get that. And so the cross section as a function of energy for something like QQ bar into photon, jet, plus gravitons scales very quickly with energy. Signal takes off to some power. The background is typically 1 over S. This is all, the background is mostly all massless states, standard model massless states from the point of view of high energy collisions. So the only scale involved in that is 1 over S. The scale here is E to the delta over MD 2 plus delta. So this is climbing quickly. But of course, you have to fold in part-time luminosity functions, which are very steeply falling functions of energy. When those are folded in to the cross-section, you get a suppression at the high energy, so everything is squashed at the high energy. But the signal still wins out over background if you go through sufficiently high energy scattering. So the statement that the higher the Vt cut, the better, is particularly true in gravitational physics of this nature. Of course, one issue is the control of the calculation. You can't go through arbitrarily high energy scattering for some fixed value of the higher dimensional fundamental gravitational scale, because then you lose control of the calculation. I mean, nature doesn't care if you lose control of the calculation, but you might worry that you've lost control of the calculation. And so there can be some fuzziness of what the prediction is at really really high energies.
Are you just talking about pseudocops, ET in them, playing calculations, control, or
anything else? Oh, no, I'm thinking in terms of doing a scattering cross-section where the center of mass, hard scattering center of mass energy, and the momentum transfer is greater than the fundamental scale of gravity. In which case, you don't have control over the calculation. But since you said that, I'll go off on a tangent again, briefly. There's nothing wrong with scattering above the Planck scale. I mean, this was a very high energy trans-Planckian collision right there. But you can sort of calculate it. It's not so difficult. The issue is that the momentum transfer was small in you know, collisions like this and so on. And the same thing with this, you can have very high energy particle scattering even within this extra-dimensional framework. With small momentum transfer, you can do eigenal resummations and get an accurate description of what is happening at very high energy. But those require that you look at observables with small momentum transfer. And it's unclear whether or not LHC would be in that neighborhood to do that, because you truly need truly need transplanting collisions for that controllability. So, okay.
Can you just take this part on luminosity? Why? I mean, you estimated the total cross section. Why did you then multiply it by something?
This is the parton cross section. So this is the QQ bar to graviton plus, let's say, photon. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, I can't just accelerate quarks. So I'm accelerating protons. Mm-hmm. And so the parton luminosity of a quark inside of a proton is like this, and then very steeply falling as a function of energy. And so when a proton is going 7 TeV, the probability of finding a quark that's going 7 TeV is extraordinarily tiny. And that's the reason why there's the steep fall off.
That's confusing to me, because the proton is just 3 quarks, so surely the quarks are typically going at 2 TeV.
They are, yes.
So why does it fall off so steeply?
Let's call this 2 TeV.
Right.
So it falls off steeply because
also the gluons carry half the momentum, right? Yeah. So there's one effect.
That's right. Yeah.
The gluons carry half the momentum. So the quarks only have half.
So gluons. It's falling steeply out here. It's falling steeply in the region where you want the most signal.
Yeah.
You want a really high energy signal, and unfortunately, it's falling steeply there.
We've had a stronger gravity. How does this affect early universe cosmology?
It can affect the early universe cosmology from the standpoint of gravitons decaying and all sorts of things. So you haven't tempted me to go to that direction, because it is a very interesting question. And it's a very long and in-depth question. Basically, what you need is the universe to be normal from our normal point of view by Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And if you can arrange that somehow, then you're good. Okay. I should say that the limits of this kind of process at the tevatron, which are the best today, are about 1 TeV, 1.4 TeV, sort of in that region for the cross-section of extra-dimensional gravitons in this scenario, which is a bit higher than the W mass, and so naturalness is a bit strained, perhaps. So your quadratic divergence is associated with the Higgs vector, but then be cut off, if this were all the correct way of doing it, by at least the scale of 1 TeV. Okay. Now, there are also S-channel graviton exchanges, virtual graviton exchanges, and the tree-level basic computation would be to take the energy momentum tensor at each vertex and then do a sum over all these states, and this is more or less the energy momentum tensor squared operator, dimension 8 operator. And that dimension 8 operator is controlled by some scale lambda t, which is of order, expected to be of order, mv, the fundamental scale. And as you know, non-renormalizable operator phenomenology is extremely difficult unless the operator is breaking some cherished symmetry. And therefore, this kind of analysis is difficult to do much better than the direct production of the Kluge-Klein excitation. And it limits from D0 with a little bit of 1 inverse Sumter bar by looking at photon-photon final states is that 1.6 TeV. Okay? So, now, I want to go very, very quickly through the Rendell-Sundrum thing and then tell you some thoughts about Higgs physics and how this ties into Higgs physics, in my view. So, Rendell-Sundrum is two brains and an etched, yes.
Sorry, not attention. Yeah. Are there limits on this from just, the graviton exchange from the perihelion of Mercury shifts and that, the astrophysical limits?
No.
No?
No, because... Not in this scenario, because the the spacing is too high. Even though from the collider point of view, the spacing is really tiny, spacing here is too big to cause an effect or propagation or anything. So Randall syndrome extra dimensions, we have a brain at the zero point and a brain at the coordinate pi in some extra dimensional fifth dimension that's S1 mod Z2 compactified. And we have a non-factorizable geometry where the normal four dimensions are pre-factored by an exponential of the extra dimension. And then this is the extra dimensional coordinate. And after doing some straightforward calculations from there, so there's lots of cleverness that they've had in coming to this, but then there's sort of zombie calculation after that, and you get that any sort of scale that was fundamental in your Lagrangian gets rescaled on this brain. If you have your, you know, everything living on this brain, gets rescaled by this exponential factor. E to the minus 2 KRC pi times, you know, normal parameters of order, say, in Planck. You consider that to be your fundamental scale, your gravitational fundamental scale. Just gets warped down to the weak scale as long as your compactification radius compared to curvature, which is very similar to in Planck, has a hierarchy of only 1 part in 10 from this viewpoint. And the phenomenology of this is that there is a zero mode that survives. It has that can be normalized through 1 over n Planck interactions, which is what you expect from gravity. And there are some Kluge-Klein excitations of the graviton, which are not quite the same as these more or less continuous Kluge-Klein excitations of ADD. These Kluge-Klein excitations are separated by zero modes. Zeros of the J1 Bessel function, and they're given by this expression. And so your first interaction eigenmode of the extra dimensional space might be 1 TeV, and then your next one is at some factor of 3 higher, and then your next one is some factor of Bessel function 0 higher. And they're discretely spaced of order a TeV space. Okay? So what this does is it forms resonances of high mass objects that couple with 1 over TeV or 1 over weak scale interaction strength. And so this is actually very similar to Z prime phenomenology in lots of ways, except for the fact that you can couple to photon-photon. And a few other things that Z primes normally don't. And the limits of this at the Tevatron are of order 1 TeV, 1.2 TeV, something like that. So everything here is of order sort of the TeV in this extra dimensional space, the limits on that. They have not found evidence for it, but there are limits. And this limit is from bump hunting. It's just from looking at some high energy E plus E minus pair, and the background might look like this, and you're hoping to find something like that, or the Randall syndrome Kluge-Klein excitation survives. Okay.
Just one question.
Yes.
What spacing you're talking about for 1 imperceptor bar? Do they have more data than that now? Like,
yeah.
How does it scale with data for
luminosity? It doesn't scale well with data, with luminosity. So in the first case, it doesn't scale well at all with luminosity. Energy is king on all this because of the high energy dependence on the observable. And so if you can get all the luminosity you want, you increase your gravity scale by just a little bit, you go from fireworks on tattoo day to nothing fast. By just a little change on scale. And so luminosity does not help much, actually. It's energy is the key.
So how, using the LHC, how would you classify the scenario or verify it?
We verify by finding this and finding that.
E plus and minus is beneath the superlinear collider.
So this is QQ bar, Q gravitons, to E plus E minus.
Yeah. So you're looking for resonance.
Yeah.
So if I'm not there, we know this is wrong.
We know that that we know that we didn't find it.
It seems to be a habit of not existing.
So you say it's like the current phenomenology, but it, you would be able to tell the difference by the tent, by the sort of by seeing some sign of its tent or something.
So there's multiple ways that you could see a difference. One is that if you're going by energy momentum tensor, then you're just coupling to energy, and so there's no sort of special charges like the Z primes. Furthermore, you're coupled to the photons. it doesn't decay into the two photon instrument. Okay, so that is so I wanted to spend half the lecture on sort of a rundown of these extra-dimensional scenarios. And now there are several ways where Higgs boson physics can be affected by extra dimensions. And one way, which I won't really talk about, but you can catch me later, I can talk more about, is these brains can fluctuate. They don't have to be rigidly spaced there. And instead of having this rigid RC, it could be T, some modulus associated with this brain separation. That modulus is a quantum field. And that quantum field, you can expand, you can put it in your metric, and you can go through all the analysis, and you find that it acts just like a standard model Higgs boson, in the sense that that modulus field couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor times some coupling scale, which is 1 over the weak scale, 1 over TeV scale. This interaction, if you think about the trace of the energy momentum tensor, the trace is masses. And the Higgs couples two masses. So this particle looks an awful lot like the Higgs boson. It's very similar to the Higgs boson, with some subtle differences, which I won't completely go through. But it also interacts with the Higgs boson. It interacts in a special way. There's some parameter T, which if you have worked in gravitational physics, you know that if you have some scalar field, you can always add this operator with dimensionless coefficient in front. And this R right there has in it sort of a box H of graviton. And if you have a Higgs boson coupling, this Higgs boson can get a vacuum expectation value, V. So you get a kinetic mixing between the radion field, which is the radion field is in this box graviton, and the Higgs field. And that kinetic mixing will ultimately mean that you neither have a pure radion nor a pure Higgs state in your spectrum. And the Higgs phenomenology at the LHC is disrupted a bit by this confluence of states. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about it. Yes.
I always get the impression that the mass of the radion in this area is actually quite low, below TeV. Is that, and it's hard to get a much larger, is that true?
It's the mass of the radion is a free parameter, which is set by the stabilizing potential.
Right, exactly.
That's right. And so it's generally expected to be parameter lower than sort of the Clusaclan excitations. But I wouldn't say that it's expected to be really, really light. I mean,
I guess I'm asking about that effect in the relationship between.
I mean, this is very standard to stabilizing fields in in any kind of extra-dimensional framework. Is that it's very difficult to have these moduli fields actually get mapped sometimes. But there's ways to do it. There's a Goldberger and Wise mechanism where they put different potentials on different brains.
So is there something else? Because in that case, you actually get a mass that's pretty low, I would say, or of the
Right?
So is there a different mechanism that boosts that
memory? I like that mechanism a lot, actually.
Why do you want to boost it?
In different contexts, in different contexts or something.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so I presume that there's ways you can adjust the parameters that you can get a larger radion mass. But the generic thing is that it's smaller. And I like that a lot. I like whatever the truth is, but... but from Higgs physics point of view, it's very interesting because that light radion is expected to couple with the light Higgs and would not cause problems with precision electro beam if it were lighter like this, which is quite
light blue one.
Pardon?
How light blue one?
100 GeV, 150 GeV in that neighborhood. Yeah.
The heat or the radiant?
Both. Yeah, yeah. The sense the radiant couples very much like the Higgs boson, if its strength is similar to the Higgs boson, then it will contribute to radiative corrections in a very similar way. And so if its mass is much greater than 200 GeV, I get very concerned because the normal issues of heavy Higgs. Okay. So, but there's more to Higgs physics than this, which is...
Just to follow up on the last thought, you're saying that if you actually made it very heavy, that would be a problem.
Well, if you made it very heavy, it could be a problem, but you have to adjust this to be heavy as well. And then the coupling strength would go down, and then you're okay. Yep. Okay. So, now from the Higgs physics point of view, there's actually another, and perhaps more generic, issue that relates ADD and Randall syndrome and any kind of framework which purports to banish all scales above the TEV scale. So we have here, we have TEV scale, and down here we have the weak scale. And we want the quadratic divergences of the Higgs boson to not be too terribly large, so this hierarchy has to be a rather small hierarchy. What this says to me is that the majesty of all of nature better has to be below here. So everything is below a TEV. And it's no longer the case where I have all this room and it's not like Walmart parking lots in Iowa anymore. You have a short amount of space. You have to solve a lot of problems in this space, but there's a lot of opportunities to find things in this space. And one of the things that I expect out of nature is that we're not alone, in the sense that for decades we have been doing particle physics for many, many decades, and we have really only been studying our bodies. We sometimes think that we're not very human-centric in our field, but we're very human-centric. Cosmologists are less human-centric than us, but we are very, very human-centric because all we care about are these quarks and electrons, and which are in us, and then copies of stuff that are in us. And we should not be so arrogant to think that that's all that nature has. And actually, I didn't want to say this on Good Friday. So I did this lecture today. So nature surely doesn't care that much about us. So there's more stuff. And all that stuff, all the majesty of all these other things, is below here. How would we find any of that extra stuff below there? And, well, there are multiple ways that you could think of doing it.
Okay, can I ask some questions?
Yes.
So what happens to the Kraken scale in this theory? I mean, there seems to be this point where when we extrapolate energies, the decoupling constants happen to meet them. It's a little bit changey. So is it just a coincidence then?
So in the supersymmetric scenario where the gauge coupling is unified nicely, in this scenario, it would be a coincidence. Yes.
Okay.
But that doesn't preclude the unification. So there are ways to get unification in this theory, but yeah. Yeah.
Regarding the verification, what are the masses of these KPMOs, resonances?
So
how do we see them at 7 TeV?
So the higher the masses, the more strained we are from the point of view of natural mass. And so I can't tell you any proof of where they are, but I can tell you that the higher they go, the more it has less to do with solving the problems of the weak scale. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Higgs boson mass is around here, so standard model Higgs, is very, very special from the point of view of this story, because it is the only state that can form a gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant operator all on its own. Now there are other operators that are gauge invariant that we can create. So E mu nu is a gauge invariant operator. It's dimension two. It's got dimension less than four. I should say I want dimensions less than four. I'll explain why in just a moment. What are all the operators in the standard model with dimensions less than four that are gauge invariant? Well, there's this one. There's the hypercharged field strength tensor. There's also HL, which is the Higgs field with the lepton doublet. This one has a hanging spinner index. This one has hanging Lorentz indices. This one doesn't have hanging anything. The hanging Lorentz index we can contrast with a spinner index. We can contract with the right-handed neutrino, and this gives very unusual and interesting and fun neutrino physics. And the neutrino physics is sort of qualitatively different than some of the other physics and particle physics. And I believe the reason being is this gauge invariant dimension less than four operator. E nu can couple to new physics, new abelian states, or x nu nu. And some people in the audience have worked on that, and I have worked on that as sort of a portal to new gauge symmetries and new hidden sectors and new hidden worlds. Here is a special opportunity, I think, because it's gauge invariant and because it's Lorentz invariant. We can do more with this generically than we can with the other. We can access more of new world physics. Now, why did I say restrict ourselves to dimension less than four for this basic exercise? The reason being is that the standard model has many operators that are gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant that are dimension four. Call this. If I were to connect to a hidden sector, I would need some scale, 1 over lambda scale, that could be quite large. And as we've talked about in the previous board, even greater than a TeV or a few TeV, these kinds of operators decouple very fast in phenomenology and can create problems for our ability to see evidences from it. So this is something I don't want to focus on, but rather renormalizable operators of dimension four or less that connect with the hidden sector, with new world stuff. And this is our best opportunity, in my view, is through the Higgs boson. Okay, now I will write down, given this, I will write down the simplest of all possible theories of dark matter, which several of you know about. Cliff might have been the originator of it, perhaps.
And Maxime was, I was a
Maxime, Maxime. Okay, Maxime and Cliff and others in here sort of know this well for years, that the simplest theory of dark matter is to write down your normal standard model Higgs potential and add to it a real scalar field which has some potential like this plus an interaction term with the standard model Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's more terms involved. And this, if we assume that phi is z2 odd, this guy is stable forever. Assuming there's no other states. Okay, so this is sort of a real scalar field of the hidden sector. It doesn't have anything to do with our bodies. It doesn't have anything to do with us. But it connects in with our astrophysics and cosmology friends who have known for a long time that there's more to us than our bodies. And it's a dark matter candidate. Now, this state, relic abundance, can be calculated by doing all these standard kinds of analyses of annihilation cross sections, Higgs. This can go into Higgs, can go into any other state. And I have a relic abundance that is going to depend on the mass of the field, the mass of the Higgs field, and the various couplings like Lambda prime. And that's a possibility and a prospect, and it has interesting implications for cosmology and astrophysics. Does it have implications for particle physics and LHC?
Yeah. I just need you for a second. So when you say pi v 2 r, what does that mean?
So under some new Z2 symmetry, mm-hmm. I can make this odd, this field odd, and then make all the other standard model particles, for example, even, and every other thing even, and then it can only be pair produced, and it can only change decay in the other step.
But are you assuming that the mass of this object is greater than the Higgs mass or smaller?
It can be, yeah. Or it can be lighter. It can be, yeah. Yep. Okay, so if you have a Higgs state which is lighter, so this phi state is lighter, let's see how do I... You need more...
ZQ symmetry is necessary for it to be...
Yes.
Otherwise it would just became...
That's right. You could put in an operator, for example, without that line, and straight
put it fine.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which would be damaging to it. Yes. Okay, so now let's assume that we have some phi field which is lighter than the Higgs, so that the Higgs can be carrying into it. And the coupling has to go like the VEV of the Higgs times the prime, given the notation that I had above. And that decay width, H phi phi, is equal to lambda prime squared V squared over pi. And A times some base vectors I won't worry about. And then we have to remember a basic statement from particle physics, an extraordinary accident in standard model physics. The extraordinary accident is that the Higgs boson is very narrow. We call it the Higgs, which is a standard model Higgs, which is very narrow. For the region of mass that precision electroweak likes it to be, okay? And the reason for that is the Higgs likes to decay into the heaviest particle it can decay into, and it couples according to that mass. And so we have, down here we have MB, we have Higgs limit of 114 GeV, and MB is about 4 GeV, and there's a big gap between the Higgs mass and the particle that it can decay to. And so the width is very narrow. Higgs to B bar goes like MCYB squared MH over 16 pi. So this is tiny. This is about 1 over 40 squared. And so if this coupling is, if it's order 1, then this dominates. Okay, so what if it dominates? What if the Higgs decay is into this dark matter? What do we do in that circumstance? And there are many different attempts. Actually, I studied this a while ago as a postdoc in the Tepton context, trying to find ways that we could find invisibly decaying Higgs. There were even some people who did this in the SSC era, and in some recent studies. And I think every time people try to come up with a new thing, they always end up reverting back to this process. This is the way you find it. It is through Z Higgs, Higgs decays invisibly, and you need this to go to E plus E minus, or mu plus mu minus. Mm-hmm. And so you get lepton, L plus, L minus, plus missing energy as your signature. Now there are obvious backgrounds to this. Here's one that you can just write down immediately. Or you box Z, this is probably the largest one, where this Z goes to L plus L minus, and this goes to neutrinos. Okay. But there are subtle differences between this signal and this background. The subtle difference is that this is caused by a p-channel exchange. And so as the propagator likes to go on shell, as momentum transfer is smaller, this process gets higher and bigger in event rate. So this tends to like to be down the beam pipe. So the reconstructed Z from the L plus L minus likes to be close to beam. Whereas here, it's rather central. You're producing through an S channel, you're producing a Higgs and a Z, they're going off in some whatever direction. It tends to be rather central, so this goes into the central region. So you can apply various centrality cuts and other cuts to the situation. There are other backgrounds that are involved. There's a W plus Z background where one of the leptons is lost. There's a Z plus jet where the jet energy is mismeasured or the jet is lost. So lots of different things. And after careful study, one finds, and I'll just give you some numbers so you get a feel for this. If the Higgs mass is 120 GeV, and or 140 GeV, I'll show you two cases. This is a 14 TeV collider, 30 inverse Spinkler Barnes, and this is Evudiazol et al., or one of the latest to study this. The signal over square root of background, which sets the significance of the discovery, is about 9.9. There's about 400 signal events. And for 140 GeV Higgs, let me go up to 160, I'll skip the 140, by 5.6. So this is just above discovery threshold by sigma, significance of 5. And this is about 200 events. And just as important to keep in mind is signal over background, because there can be systematic errors in your and if this is less than 10%, you should be worried. But this is a border 30%. So no trouble. Okay. Yes.
So is this process more promising than weak boson fusion?
I think weak boson fusion actually adds more to this than that. So you need extra jets. So I think I wrote this down incorrectly. I believe that you want to do this, and you have these so-called tagging jets at very high momentum. And so you tag that, you recognize that there's a weak boson fusion process going on. That sort of helps you with this background a little bit as well.
But not just weak boson fusion, just to Higgs case invisible.
No, that does not work. No.
I thought that was a good name.
No, but if that has a chance of working, it would take decades. Well, not decades, years. Because you have to really know these jet energy scales extremely well before you can start saying, oh, I have some missing energy signature in addition to these two jets inside. So, yeah, what you're referring to is do the same thing here, but put a Higgs here and let the Higgs go.
30% more in years, too.
I don't know. 30 inverse Spinkler Barnes in a good is a couple of good years, yeah. But I'm just saying that you will find this type of signal, guaranteed quicker than jets at high pseudorapidity and then an internal Higgs. I mean, there's QCD uncertainties associated with this as well, by the way. This is related to Pomeroy physics. So Pomeroy physics is, I'm getting off on a tangent, I'll just say that
you had me at Pomeroy.
Yeah. Right, okay, so I convinced, when I said the word Pomeroy, I convinced a lot of people listening.
So if you see that, since it's missing energy, how can you tell it's a fact?
You have a difficult time knowing with metaphysical certainty what it was. That's right. But you would develop actually very good intuition about it. And the way you would make a good story is that you would look at the total rate. There's several observables involved with this. There's the TT distribution of the Z, which you measure carefully with lots of luminosity. It'll be consistent with recoiling against the scalar. You have the overall production cross section. You would be convinced in time that this was the case.
You think so?
I would be convinced in time. This is what.
So if you combine this with the omega, does that fix the two parameters? Does that fix the M5 and lambda prime? If you measured this, right, then you measured. Can you use those to fix both parameters?
You could, if you believe that nature, yeah, that's right. Yeah. You could certainly do that test, in fact. One of the difficulties, though, is that the 5-4 coupling of the Higgs will play a role in this.
Okay, so
And that is unlikely to be measured well at the LHC. So they still hold hope for it, but yeah.
Can you break the Z2 symmetry in the extra Lagrangian or the intersectional Lagrangian for maybe this can boost the mass of Higgs, or are you going to still run into the same problems?
This whole theory would go wrong if you. But let's the next thing I'm going to write down, since I only have 5+ epsilon minutes, I'll write down something which sort of breaks the CC symmetry. Okay. So I can in my universe of many different fields and so on.
is your story sensitive to the mass of the 5 particle? The LHC story, or is it something which once the 5 particle is light enough that the decays happen a lot that you don't really care much?
The latter, yes. Yeah. So the dot phase space will depend on it a bit, but other than that, no. Right. Okay.
Why do you say that the soft interaction is important for the abundance?
Because the Higgs coupling will relate to it.
The Higgs soft
interaction.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant to buy something.
It's the Higgs. That's the Higgs soft interaction. Which would be. But you don't know that with certainty, that because there can be sort of additional coupling and additional contributions to the Lagrangian, 5-6 interaction, and so on. That
you just took the case of the Higgs being of the particles being lighter than the Higgs mass, right? So is this possible?
You were thinking.
Yeah, so this process doesn't matter.
If
the particle is heavier than the Higgs, it looks pretty close to what we see anyway.
Yeah, and certainly the 5-4, the little 5-4 interaction won't play a role because there's no spontaneous breaking, and there's no
zero.
Yeah, it's totally irrelevant. Yeah. Yeah, so you might be able to pin it down pretty well, actually. Yeah, through observables. Mm-hmm. Okay, so lastly, in the last few minutes, let me just I will shorten this by a lot and just say I'm going to, instead of using this interaction, I will use a complex scalar field, which gets to that kind of expectation value. Maybe it breaks some U1 symmetry, maybe some other symmetry, but it, you get a vacuum expectation value. And this causes mixing. So there's going to be, so the light eigenstate mixing of these two states will go like this. So let's imagine that we have a little Higgs that comes from this doublet, and a phi Higgs that comes from that doublet. And now you have mixing. The mixing goes like the BEV of that field times the BEV of the Higgs field times the coupling. So maybe some coupling here. So it's coupling. So this is the mixing. So you need both BEVs and you need a coupling. And what mixing does is it does this to the eigenstates, level repulsion to the eigenstates. And you get a S1 field and an S2 field, mass eigenstates. Now, this is some hidden sector state that doesn't couple to SU2, it doesn't know anything about anything, it doesn't care. And when you do this level repulsion, all that's happening is that you're changing the mass here and you're stealing away electrorecoupling from the Higgs. So this mass eigenstate now will have some electrorecoupling to the vector bosons and so on. And this will have a little bit less, or maybe a lot less, depending on what the mixing is, compared to the standard model Higgs. So let's say that this state goes above detectability. So we cannot detect easily. Cannot detect. And this state is about 120 GeV or 130, 140, some reasonably standard Higgs boson mass state. What do you do about this at the collider? How do you go about seeing this effect? If the mixing is small, you will never know. There's a stealing effect away from the coupling. Let's even say 10% stealing effect. You run the collider for years and years and years, and people say, so next to the Mescalini order PCD calculation of this has a 10% uncertainty, and okay, it came in a little low, fine, there's the Higgs, there's nothing else. And you could conclude that for years and years, you could conclude that, in fact. But there's this state. This state might be in the trans-TED region. And from the limits of extra dimensional theory, this might be a very good thing to think about. This sort of a state that's sort of above TED scale, trans-TED region, trans-TED mass. Would you ever see it? And the answer is, after a long, long, long time, you might be able to see it. And you would see it through this. So if you have these tagging jets, this is helpful. You have this S2 state, which has some small diminished coupling to the vector bosons. And then what's it going to want to decay to? It's going to want to decay to vector bosons. This is unlike the heavy Higgs's of supersymmetry. The heavy Higgs's of supersymmetry and these two doublet models were decoupled doublets, they do not decay to vector bosons. There's an extremely rapid decoupling process of those states. And so the whole game in heavy Higgs boson phenomenology and supersymmetry is fermions, or perhaps superpartners, but it's not vector bosons. Here is vector bosons. 100%, nearly 100% of the decay is the vector bosons, not even top quarks. And it goes to vector bosons, and a very good signature would be W's, where this goes to lepton neutrino, and this goes to jet. And then after waiting for how much time did the, how many 100 inverse Fermat de Barnes. Okay? I'm going to show you something from 100 inverse Fermat de Barnes. This is d sigma dm jet lepton neutrino. And this is the invariant mass of jet lepton neutrino, where the neutrino is reconstructed by assuming that the missing energy was from, the missing 4 vector was from reconstructing W. And the background looks like this. And this is 1.1 TeV. let's call this mass 1.1 keV. Background looks like this, and the signal looks like this, not quite drawn scale, but small, overlaying it. After 100 inverse femtobarns, you will see, after many different cuts, I studied this with Bowen, Tui, and myself, you would find 13 signal events in this region, from 1.0 to 1.2 TeV, 13 signal versus 7 background. That's tough business. And but if that's enough, actually, experimentalists will say, okay, you did all the cuts right and you did all those things right, and experimentalists are studying this. This is what the story would be at the LHC. You find a Higgs boson, maybe nothing else, maybe some other signature direction, and then after a long period of time, slowly developing out of the background, sort of like a web page loading at Econolodge, this signal would pop up and start developing, and then it would become clearer and clearer over time. And
you like 10 or 20 years?
Well, 100 inverse femtobarns could be 10 years.
That's
14 TeV. Yeah.
So just as about to turn it off, they'll start seeing this, right?
Right. But there's many potential motivations for the super LHC, which is the high luminosity LHC. They're already studying it, and they're going to do it. I mean, it's pretty much guaranteed they're going to do it if they can make the detectors work right. And that's where you can get potentially 100 inverse femtobarns in a year, if it all goes well, and you can find detectors that can handle it. So that's somewhere around 2018 or so.
What's the main design change?
It's just some accelerated design issue to boil off more and depth. And you have to. Getting bunches with that many particles requires sort of everything changing, including optics and including, you know, the bunch spacing filtering. So it's a difficult process, but the accelerated physicists believe that they can do this. The detector people, to my understanding, are ones who are not so sure that they can handle it. And but this is sort of one motivation that has an extra dimensional flavor to it. And this is really where luminosity helps instead of just energy.
So are you also assuming this phi is dark matter?
No, this is not the dark matter. No, this phi is not.
For what reason is it not?
Because it spontaneously breaks whatever symmetry it might have. Yeah. And so this phi can actually be gained to Higgs if it were vice versa. So it can be gained to off shell Higgs, which is the Fermi.
So how is crashing signal versus then a background in detection? I mean, since like 2 sigma, right?
Oh, this is a Poisson statistics you require for this, and 13 signal events versus 13 signal events on top of the expected 7 background events is
on top of the
okay. So the background is 7 events in that range, and then on top of that is 13 okay. events. So So it's doable. It's likely doable in less than 100 inverse femtobarns, but this is the benchmark that we chose. And there's other signatures of ZZ and so on that you can do.
Okay. Everybody's looking at underground experiments for everybody. Lots of people.
Yeah.
So this five should be able to see it somehow, depending on where you see it. Because it would interact. Interactive with Higgs is going to interact with something else.
Yeah.
And there has to be an independent check.
I think that'd be great, yeah. I'm all in favor of keeping those experiments going. Yeah. Okay, so I think we'll just end there. Thank you. See you tomorrow.